Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week, I have a reading about cancer prevention from Medical Express News. I'll have three selections from the Guardian newspaper. I'm going to wrap up the program with book reviews from the Black Agenda Report and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. And I'm starting with this reading about historically black colleges and universities titled, HBCUs Ponder Their Future as 47th President Makes Cuts to Education Dollars. This was published April 15, 2025, in the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper and its afro.com website. The nation's historically black colleges and universities, known as HBCUs, are wondering how to survive in an uncertain and contentious educational climate as the Trump administration downsizes the scope and purpose of the U.S. Department of Education, while cutting away at federal funding for higher education. In January, President Donald Trump signed an executive order pausing federal grants and loans, alarming HBCUs where most students rely on Pell Grants or federal aid. The order was later rescinded, but ongoing cuts leave key support systems in political limbo, said Denise Smith, Deputy Director of Higher Education Policy and a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a left-leaning think tank. Leaders worry about Trump's rollback of the Justice 40 initiative, a climate change program that relied on HBCUs to tackle environmental justice issues, she said. And there's uncertainty around programs such as Federal Work Study and TRIO, which provides college access services to disadvantaged students. People are being mum because we're starting to see a chilling effect, Smith said. There's a real fear that resources could be lost at any moment, even the ones schools already know they need to survive. Most students at HBCUs rely on Pell Grants or other federal aid, and a fifth of black college graduates matriculate from HBCUs. Other minority-serving institutions, known as MSIs, that focus on Hispanic and American Indian populations, also heavily depend on federal aid. It's still unclear what these cuts will mean for HBCUs and MSIs, even though they're supposedly protected, Smith said. States may be unlikely to make up any potential federal funding cuts to their public HBCUs, and the schools already have been underfunded by states compared with predominantly white schools. Congress created public land-grant universities under the Morrill Act of 1862 to serve the country's agricultural and industrial industries, providing 10 million acres taken from tribes and offering it for public universities such as Auburn and the University of Georgia. But black students were excluded. The 1890 Morrill Act required states to either integrate or establish separate land-grant institutions for black students, leading to the creation of many HBCUs. These schools have since faced chronic underfunding compared to their majority white counterparts. In 2020, the average endowment of white land-grant universities was $1.9 billion, compared with just $34 million for HBCUs, according to Forbes. There are other HBCUs that don't stem from the 1890 law, including well-known private schools such as Fisk University, Howard University, Morehouse College, and Spelman College. But more than three-fourths of HBCU students attend public universities, meaning state lawmakers play a significant role in their funding and oversight. Mary Beth Gassman, an endowed chair in education and a distinguished professor at Rutgers University, isn't impressed by what states have done for HBCUs and other minority-serving institutions so far. She said she isn't sure there is a state model that can bridge the massive funding inequities for these institutions, even in states better known for their support. I don't think North Carolina or Maryland have done a particularly good job at the state level, nor have any of the other states. Students at HBCUs are funded at roughly 50 to 60% of what students at predominantly white institutions are funded. That's not right, said Gassman. Most of the bipartisan support has come from the U.S. Congress and the result of important work by HBCUs and affiliated organizations. I don't know of a state model that works well, as none of them are equitable. Under federal law, states that accept federal land grant funding are required to match every dollar with state funds. But in 2023, the Biden administration sent letters to 16 governors warning them that their public black land grant institutions had been underfunded by more than $12 billion over 3 decades. Tennessee State University alone had a $2.1 billion gap with the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. At a February meeting hosted by the Tennessee Black Caucus of State Legislators, Tennessee State Interim President Dwayne Tucker said the school is focused on asking lawmakers this year for money to keep the school running. Otherwise, Tucker said at the time, the institution could run out of cash around April or May. That's real money. That's the money we should work on, Tucker said, according to a video of the forum. In some states, lawsuits to recoup long-standing underfunding have been one course of action. In Maryland, a landmark $577 million legal settlement was reached in 2021 to address decades of underfunding at 4 public HBCUs. In Georgia, 3 HBCU students sued the state in 2023 for underfunding of 3 HBCUs. In Tennessee, a recent state report found Tennessee State University has been shortchanged roughly $150 million to $544 million over the past 100 years. But Tucker says he thinks filing a lawsuit doesn't make much sense for Tennessee State. There's no account payable set up with the state of Tennessee to pay us $2.1 billion, Tucker said at the February forum. And if we want to make a conclusion about whether that money is real or not, you're going to have to sue the state of Tennessee. And I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense. There are 102 HBCUs across 19 states, Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Virgin Islands, though a large number of HBCUs are concentrated in the South. Alabama has the most with 14, and Pennsylvania has the farthest north HBCU. Beyond education, HBCUs contribute roughly $15 billion annually to their local economies, generate more than 134,000 jobs, and create $46.8 billion in career earnings, proving themselves to be economic anchors in under-resourced regions. Homecoming events at HBCUs significantly bolster local economies, local studies show. North Carolina Central University's homecoming contributes approximately $2.5 million to Durham's economy annually. Similarly, Hampton University's 2024 homecoming was projected to inject around $3 million into the city of Hampton and the coastal Virginia region, spurred by increased visitor spending and retail sales. In Tallahassee, Florida A&M University's 2024 homecoming week in October generated about $5.1 million from Sunday to Thursday. Their significance is especially pronounced in southern states, such as North Carolina, where HBCUs account for just 16% of four-year schools, but serve 45% of the state's black undergraduate population. Smith has been encouraged by what she's seen in states such as Maryland, North Carolina, and Tennessee, which have a combined 20 HBCUs among them. Lawmakers have taken piecemeal steps to expand support for HBCUs through policy and funding, she noted. Tennessee became the first state in 2018 to appoint a full-time statewide higher education official dedicated to HBCU success for institutions such as Fisk and Tennessee State. Meanwhile, North Carolina launched a bipartisan, bicameral HBCU caucus in 2023 to advocate for its 10 HBCUs, known as the NC10, and spotlight their $1.7 billion annual economic impact. We created a bipartisan HBCU caucus because we needed people in both parties to understand these institutions' importance. If you represent a district with an HBCU, you should be connected to it, said North Carolina Democratic Senator Gladys Robinson, an alum of private HBCU Bennett College and state HBCU North Carolina A&T State University. It took constant education, getting folks to come and see, talk about what was going on, she recalled. It's like beating the drum constantly until you finally hear the beat. For Robinson, advocacy for HBCUs can be a tough task, especially when fellow lawmakers aren't aware of the stories of these institutions. North Carolina A&T was among the 1890 land-grant universities historically undermatched in federal agricultural and extension funding. The North Carolina Promise Tuition Plan, launched in 2018, reduced in-state tuition to $500 per semester and out-of-state tuition to $2,500 per semester at a handful of schools that now include HBCU's Elizabeth City State University and Fayetteville State University. Western Carolina University, a Hispanic-serving institution, and UNC at Pembroke, founded in 1887 to serve American Indians. Through conversations on the floor of the General Assembly and with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, Robinson advocated to ensure Elizabeth City State, a struggling HBCU, was included, which helped revive enrollment and public investment. I'm hopeful because we've been here before, Robinson said in an interview. These institutions were built out of churches and land by people who had nothing, just so we could be educated, Robinson said. We have people in powerful positions across the country. We have to use our strength and our voices. Alumni must step up. It's tough, but not undoable. Meanwhile, other states are working to recognize certain colleges that offer significant support to black college students. California last year passed a law creating a Black Serving Institution designation, the first such title in the country. Schools must have programs focused on black achievement, retention, and graduation rates, along with a 5-year plan to improve them. Sacramento State University is among the first receiving the designation. And this session, California State Assembly member Mike Gibson, a Democrat, introduced legislation that proposes a $75 million grant program to support black and underserved students over 5 years through the designation of California Black Serving Institutions Grant Program. The bill was most recently referred to the Assembly's Appropriations Committee. That was the article, HBCUs Ponder Their Future as 47th President Makes Cut to Education Dollars. This was published in the Baltimore Afro-American Newspaper's Afro.com website on April 15, 2025. My next reading is from the Guardian newspaper. The title is, Georgia University Receives $500,000 Grant to Preserve Gullah Geechee Heritage. This was written by Adria Walker and published April 22, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, Georgia State University will establish the Gullah Geechee Sacred Land Project to research and protect the community and its culture. A new $500,000 Mellon Grant will allow Georgia State University to develop archival, historical, and cultural research to protect Gullah Geechee heritage in communities in Georgia and South Carolina. Using the grant, GSU will establish the Gullah Geechee Sacred Land Project, GGSLP, which will be dedicated to maintaining African-American burial grounds by recovering communities' spiritual, genealogical, and spatial lineages and safeguarding the places where those communities interred their ancestors, according to a statement by the college. The Gullah Geechee people are the descendants of formerly enslaved West Africans who were forced to work across the coastal southern United States. They created their own rich culture and language, both of which are still practiced and spoken by their descendants today. After the Emancipation Proclamation, the Gullah Geechee decided to remain in their own lands, which now make up what is formerly known as the Gullah Geechee Corridor, spanning from North Carolina to Florida. Across the corridor, Gullah Geechee people are facing extreme land loss from climate crisis, gentrification, and the development of their lands by outsiders. The fight to maintain Gullah Geechee lands continues today, with people awaiting to hear the Georgia Supreme Court's decision in a case that could ensure the preservation of one of the last intact Gullah Geechee communities. Gullah Geechee people are also working to preserve their cultural traditions and language, and to ensure those are passed down to coming generations. With stakes this dire, a program like the GGSLP is increasingly important. GGSLP will be led by Ross Michael Brown and Tiffany Player, assistant history professors at Georgia State University. Undergraduate and graduate students who are interested in studying Gullah Geechee culture and traditions will have the chance to do so while also having research, preservation, and community engagement opportunities. The Mellon Foundation's funding allows us to strengthen our relationships with Gullah Geechee communities and support their ongoing efforts to honor their ancestors and the legacies they left for descendants, Brown said in a statement. Georgia State University's new undergraduate and graduate curricula will include 4 courses on oral tradition and folklore, immersive service learning experiences, and the establishment of an interdisciplinary GGSLP lab. Graduate students, under the direction of Chad Keller, co-investigator of the project, will have the opportunity to receive a newly created Cultural Resource Management Certificate. This partnership with the Mellon Foundation will enable students to conduct and access groundbreaking research and meaningfully connect with the people and histories that make up one of the most innovative learning environments in the country, M. Brian Blake, the president of Georgia State University, said in a statement. That was the article, Georgia University Receives $500,000 Grant to Preserve Gullah Geechee Heritage. This appeared in the Guardian newspaper on April 22, 2025, and was written by Adria R. Walker. Now I have a reading about Gullah Geechee history titled, The Little-Known Gullah Geechee Politician Who Pushed for the 14th Amendment. This appeared in the Guardian newspaper and its theguardian.com website. It was written by Adria Walker and published February 20, 2025. After Donald Trump issued an executive order to limit birthright citizenship, Marilyn Hemingway, the CEO and president of the Gullah Geechee Chamber of Commerce, knew she had to do something. Based in Georgetown, South Carolina, the GGCC helps preserve the history of Gullah Geechee people, the Africans who were enslaved in the Sea Islands along the Atlantic coast and their descendants. One such person was Joseph Hayne Rainey, a man born in Georgetown and enslaved until his father purchased his freedom when he was 10. Rainey was the first black person elected to the United States Congress when he was known for his support of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868 and stated, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. The amendment was necessary to give the roughly 4.5 million black people in the country citizenship after emancipation. As a previous Supreme Court case, Dred Scott v. Sanford, had denied citizenship to all people of African descent. Rainey's support for the laws passed during Reconstruction was deeply informed by his life in enslavement. He spent much of his time in Congress fighting to protect black Americans and to ensure the 14th and 15th Amendments, the latter of which prohibited the federal government from denying a citizen the right to vote based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude, were enforced. The 14th Amendment was passed and ratified because once those who were enslaved were emancipated, it was like they didn't have standing, Hemingway said. Where were they in this world now? They were no longer enslaved, so they needed to be made citizens. Rainey went from an enslaved person to an emancipated person to a citizen. His personal story reflects the American story. Now, the amendment that has long granted birthright citizenship is being used by the U.S. president to deny citizenship to the children of recent immigrants. The 14th Amendment has never been interpreted to extend citizenship universally to everyone born in the United States, his EO reads. It has always excluded from birthright citizenship persons who were born in the United States, but not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Trump's executive order almost immediately faced several lawsuits from civil rights groups and Democratic attorneys generals, as well as a temporary restraining order from a federal judge. A federal appeals court has denied the administration's request to reinstate a ban. But the threat still looms, especially as the president has said he expects the Supreme Court to side with him on the decision. The first line of the 14th Amendment was designed to say that anyone who was born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States is a citizen, said Jamal Green, a professor at Columbia Law School. That doesn't depend on their race or their ethnicity or anything else about them. The only question is whether they're subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Trump's administration has harped on the phrase, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, which was understood to refer to people who were not subject to U.S. law, Green said. That would have meant diplomats from other countries, indigenous people who were sovereign, and potentially an invading army. But now Trump is trying to use that language to apply to a wide group of people, including children whose parents were not lawfully in the United States at the time of their birth. Green said that those who support such an understanding of the law were suggesting that those people would not have an allegiance to the United States. But that interpretation is not consistent with how it would have been originally understood, he said. And it's also not consistent with the language itself. Since jurisdiction is not a reference to allegiance, it's a reference to whether United States laws apply to those people. Some are also concerned about the order's potential reach to citizens such as Black Americans. The Gullah Geechee Chamber of Commerce, for its part, argues that Trump's order is an attempt to undo some of Rainey's work. For Rainey, the 14th Amendment was not just for Black Americans. It was for everyone. To all people born unnaturalized into the United States, the 14th Amendment is the first time in the history of the United States that it actually covered citizenship, including a formerly enslaved people, Hemingway said. They were the impetus for this, but it covered everyone. So we have to be very careful when we come and we start attacking it, because it's not just going to remove citizenship of immigrants, it's going to remove citizenship of everyone. Though the restraining order blocks Trump's plan, the future of birthright citizenship will be undecided until the Supreme Court hears the case. In the meantime, Hemingway is continuing to promote Rainey's life and continue his fight. This is why we speak out to make sure correct history is told. We still have to have the same fight for civil rights. Rainey's actions inform our actions to this day. His story needs to be told more so that we could hold all our elected officials accountable to the United States Constitution. We are in a constitutional crisis. His life explains why we continue to fight. That was the article, The Little-Known Gullah Geechee Politician Who Pushed for the 14th Amendment. This was written by Adria Walker and published February 20th, 2025 in the Guardian newspaper. Next is another reading about Gullah Geechee culture that focuses on language. It's from the Guardian newspaper. The title is, Patois is Not Broken English, The African Ties That Bind U.S. and Caribbean Languages. This was written by Zakiya McKenzie and published April 5, 2025 in the Guardian newspaper. The subtitle to the story is, Centuries Later, Jamaican Patois and United States Gullah Creole retain many Africanisms adopted from enslaved people. In 2000, I won a writing competition that awakened me to the depth and variety of Caribbean languages. As the Jamaican finalist for My Caribbean Essay Competition, I joined more than 20 children from the region to form the youth delegation of the 24th Caribbean Tourism Conference in Bridgetown, Barbados. I spent days with peers from islands that, until then, I did not know existed, such as the small but brilliant St. Eustatius and Saba in the Leeward Islands. What I remembered most are the simple greetings and phrases the other children and I taught one another in our different creoles. Every child had an official language they wrote in to win their national competition: English, French, Dutch, etc. But as soon as we were comfortable enough, we ditched those and shared as much as we could in our everyday tongues. It was during the futuristic fervor of the new millennium, so the My Caribbean competition tasked us with writing about three things we would preserve from our country in a time capsule to the year 3000. In my memory box was the work of Louise Miss Lou Bennett Coverley, a poet, performer, and advocate of Jamaican language. Like most other children in Jamaica, I first learned to recite poetry by Miss Lou in school. Her work developed in the vein of writers such as Claude McKay, who defied linguistic standards of the early 20th century and wrote for the Jamaican dialect. Miss Lou's use of Jamaican Creole, called patois, brought new appreciation to the language from the 1940s onwards. Until then, English had been the language of education and art. Patois was shunned in official settings. The independence era of the 1950s and early 1960s coincided with the rise of patois in literature and music, and by the 1970s it was firmly embedded in reggae, writing, and performance. Miss Lou went on to produce and host a Jamaican children's show called Ring Ding, which broadcast from 1970 to 1982. Despite this, there has been little national desire or governmental effort to recognize a formalized Jamaican Creole, and English remains the only official language of the land. Though patois is the first language of many Jamaicans, there is still a stigma associated with its use. This is unsurprising for a language formed as a medium for enslaved people from different parts of Africa and the Americas to communicate with one another and their enslavers on Caribbean sugar plantations. But patois is not broken English. While English was the lexifier, or base language, patois finds much of its structure and vocabulary in the West and Central African languages of the people who found the majority black population of the island. Whether or not the government recognizes it, Jamaican Creole has consistent grammatical rules as well as generations of native speakers to qualify it as a language. Gullah Creole is similar to Jamaican Patois. The Gullah people are African Americans from the southeastern coastal plain and sea islands of the United States through North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Also referred to as Geechee for their connection to the Ogeechee River, Gullah Geechee people retain many of the Africanisms adopted from enslaved people trafficked into the area. Gullah Geechee speakers report being asked if they are from Jamaica when others hear them talk, when Caribbean people might be shocked to hear African Americans use structures of grammar or patterns of intonation that they can understand. The link is not unfounded. Gullah people speak the only African-influenced English Creole in the United States. It is connected to the English-speaking Caribbean through words that the Jamaican-born linguist Frederick Cassidy referred to as virtually Pan-African. Nam in Gullah means to eat, just as Niam does in Patois, Neon for Suriname Creole speakers, and Niami to Fula speakers of the Senegambian region. Additionally, Anglophone Caribbean and Gullah Creoles use variations of the word uno, unu, or ona, you lot in British vernacular, a retention carried over by enslaved Africans from the Igbo language region. Like Jamaicans, Gullah speakers make plural nouns by adding dem to highlight more than one. So, your yeye dem refers to your eyes, and the chair dem points to multiple chairs. Gullah also uses reduplication for emphasis. A Gullah speaker might refer to a delicious meal as swit swit, while a Jamaican will similarly say sweet sweet or nice nice. Both languages also follow the common conjugation style of English-based Creoles, where verbs remain in the infinitive and are modified by words such as ah, did, fa, and been to mark tense. For instance, him da go, him a go would be understood to Gullah Creole and Patois speakers as he is going. There is merit in preserving Gullah culture by studying its Creole alongside the native tongues of the Caribbean. The U.S. Sea Islands and the English-speaking Caribbean have vastly different political and social geographies. However, a shared language and colonial history join the cultures in distinct ways. At the turn of the new millennium, Nickelodeon stopped airing a favorite TV show of mine, Ron and Natalie Daisy's children's program, Gullah Gullah Island. Something I did not realize until sitting to write this article is that the name of the human-sized yellow frog on Gullah Gullah Island, Binya Binya, is how Gullah people say, "We've been here. We Binya Binya." Jamaicans might say the same thing, "We Binya, we Deya, we been Deya." There's an irony in this show ending just as I was becoming exposed to the variance and multiplicity of Caribbean language. But as we expand the body of knowledge of Creolization in the Americas and the sociolinguistic impact of colonization, we are likely to encounter new and surprising connections between our cultures. Through these ties and familiarity, we can hope to keep our languages alive. That was the article, "Patois is Not Broken English: The African Ties That Bind U.S. and Caribbean Languages." This appeared in the Guardian newspaper on April 5, 2025, and was written by Zakia McKenzie. My next reading is from the website medicalexpressnews.com. It's titled, "African American Men See Biggest Survival Gain from Healthier Lifestyles Post-Prostate Cancer Diagnosis." This was written by Justin Jackson and published March 4, 2025. Research conducted across multiple institutions, including the University of Southern California, University of Hawaii, and Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, reported that healthier lifestyle and dietary behaviors after prostate cancer diagnosis were linked to improved survival. A significant association was found for African American men in reducing prostate cancer-specific deaths. African American men with higher lifestyle scores had a 54% lower risk of dying from prostate cancer compared to those with lower lifestyle scores. Prostate cancer remains a leading cause of cancer-related death among men in the United States, prompting inquiries into modifiable behaviors that might improve outcomes. African American men face the highest risk of prostate cancer-specific death, making it essential to explore how lifestyle factors influence survival outcomes. Prior research suggests that modifiable behaviors, such as diet and exercise, could play a role in improving prognosis. Evidence suggests post-diagnosis smoking, eating processed foods, and high-fat dairy consumption can raise mortality risks. Exercise has also been associated with reduced prostate cancer mortality and improved physical functioning. In the study, Race and Ethnicity, Lifestyle, Diet, and Survival in Patients with Prostate Cancer, published in JAMA Network Open, researchers applied a prospective cohort approach to investigate the influence of healthy lifestyle and dietary patterns on survival outcomes. Study participants were men aged 45 to 75 recruited between 1993 and 1996 in the multi-ethnic cohort. Those with non-metastatic prostate cancer completed a follow-up questionnaire between 2003 and 2008. Data on diet, physical activity, body mass index, and smoking were captured alongside clinical information from state cancer registries. Researchers measured lifestyle and dietary quality via multiple indices, including the 2021 Prostate Cancer Behavior Score and the Healthy Eating Index 2015. Cox proportional hazards models were used to assess associations with all-cause cardiovascular disease, related and prostate cancer-specific mortality. Findings show that healthier post-diagnostic habits corresponded to lower all-cause mortality, driven primarily by fewer cardiovascular disease deaths. African-American participants exhibited a notable benefit in prostate cancer-specific outcomes with higher lifestyle scores, while no strong associations emerged for other groups. Researchers noted that African-American men in the study had lower initial lifestyle scores, indicating a greater opportunity for improvement. Compared to other groups, they had the highest rates of pro-inflammatory and pro-insulin-anemic diets, factors linked to increased mortality. The strong survival benefit observed in this group suggests that adopting healthier behaviors, such as improved diet and increased physical activity, may be particularly impactful in reducing their prostate cancer-specific mortality risk. Healthy eating choices were associated with a reduced risk of all-cause mortality. No diet or lifestyle indices showed consistent reductions in prostate cancer-specific deaths across the entire cohort. Conclusions indicated that men with non-metastatic prostate cancer may benefit from behavioral counseling to address comorbid conditions, thereby improving overall survival. Researchers emphasized the necessity for continued investigation in larger and more diverse populations. That was the article, African American Men See Biggest Survival Gain from Healthier Lifestyles Post-Prostate Cancer Diagnosis. This was written by Justin Jackson and published March 4, 2025, at the website of Medical Express News. I'm going to wrap up this week's African American Hour with a couple of book reviews. The first is titled, The Stained Glass Window, A Family History as the American Story, 1790 to 1958, written by David Levering Lewis. The title of the book review is, Scholar's New Book Excavates This History, written by Gavin Godfrey, and this appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 19, 2025. Over a video chat, David Levering Lewis is sharing the story about how he found the muse for his latest book inside one of Atlanta's oldest churches. Nearly 10 years ago, the New York University professor, historian, and Pulitzer Prize winner was sitting in historic First Congregational Church admiring a triptych of stained glass windows installed to honor families crucial to its construction. One pane in particular stood out, a luminous image depicting the Madonna and Child against a backdrop of dark blue skies. Partially missing at the bottom was a memorial dedication to Lewis's maternal grandmother, Alice King Bell. The matriarch's image on the pane was created with Bell's likeness. That's when it dawned on him. I thought that I didn't know really a great deal about my past. I didn't know much about her, but I had, of course, heard the echoes of what she was supposed to mean, Lewis told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Lewis's latest book, The Stained Glass Window, A Family History as the American Story, 1790 to 1958, released on February 11th, took the scholar outside of his comfort zone, digging into the turning points, tragedies, and triumphs befalling black families such as his. Whereas his first 11 books chronicled the lives of others, The Stained Glass Window is Lewis's most personal work. By exploring more about the woman in the window, Lewis was simultaneously shocked, hurt, and proud of what pre- and post-Civil War America revealed about his family and himself. I thought, well, let me understand how my own life can be representative of so much of our collective history, he said. When it comes to helping Americans understand the past, there are few greater than Lewis. Two of his biographies on W.E.B. Du Bois won Pulitzer Prizes. He's one of the earliest biographers of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and documenters of the Harlem Renaissance. With The Stained Glass Window, Lewis's journey covers three centuries sprouting from his family tree with stops that include Roswell, Liberty County, Americus, Atlanta, and parts of South Carolina. That story revolves around four families. There was the white slaveholding Kings of Roswell and Belvins of Houston County, the South Carolina Bells, free people of color that owned slaves who ended up on Auburn Avenue. Rounding out the familial quartet were the Lewises, a family navigating life in post-Emancipation Proclamation Georgia. At the onset, Lewis thought his latest project, originally written in the third person, would be a family book about some interesting people. That modest mission took a major turn as Lewis pursued census, tax, and insurance data that led him to Alice Bell's mother, Clarissa King, whom was said to have had origins in Roswell. After connecting with an archivist, Lewis learned Clarissa King was an enslaved woman born in Liberty County who followed her master, James Belvin, to Roswell. In a revelation that floored him, Lewis confirmed his genetic link to James Belvin with an assistant from a professional genealogist. James Belvin fathered 5 children with Clarissa King, his wife's maid. Her complicated lineage aroused my deepest professional and personal fascination, Lewis writes in Chapter 2, Clarissa's Bargain. The aforementioned bargain alludes to the miscegenation between slaves and their masters in the antebellum South. The relationship between James Belvin and Clarissa King resulted in the freed slaves living on Wheat Street, now Auburn Avenue, in Atlanta when he passed. My great-grandfather, the slave master, was a curiously positive force, Lewis said. That is to say, he did not buy slaves. He did not sell slaves. He opposed secession. And at the end of the day, he was outwitted by the woman in his life. There are layers of his history here that I've got to excavate, and so I did, he said. Through slavery, the Civil War, Reconstruction, and the Civil Rights Movement, Lewis dedicates considerable focus to the experiences of his family members, their stories of survival. A major character of Lewis's story is Atlanta. It's the city where his family's church was built. The stained glass window got there by way of dedication from his maternal grandfather after the 1906 Atlanta race massacre. Lewis's father, John Henry Lewis, served as president of Morris Brown College from 1920 to 1928 and 1951 to 1958. An admirer of Du Bois and Thurgood Marshall, John Henry Lewis was a champion for black education in the South, leading schools in Arkansas and Ohio before moving the family to Atlanta for his second successful stint at Morris Brown. To this day, the John Henry Lewis Gymnasium still stands as a monument to its namesake. Lewis's mother, Alice Ernestine Bell, was inspired by activists such as Carrie Steele. She was part of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's New Women's Registration Committee, which helped secure victory in a 1921 bond election vote that led to the construction of 4 new black elementary schools and Booker T. Washington High School. The latter was Atlanta's first high school for black youth. It's also where Alice Ernestine Bell became a teacher of mathematics. She also directed school plays, mentoring a young Ava Rutland and Lena Horne. When historically black colleges and universities struggled with enrollment during the Great Depression, she graduated with a Bachelor of Arts as a Morehouse woman in 1929. Yes, that was a thing. It's in Atlanta where Lewis explores where stories of black progress clashed with racism, classism, and violence that came with the city's power structure pre-1960s. The most telling example Lewis finds of this is the 1948 death of his cousin, who was severely beaten by police in Atlanta for allegedly stealing cigarettes from a country club. Reports in the Atlanta Daily World, at the time the country's only black daily newspaper, said Lewis's cousin died from blunt force head trauma as a result of police brutality. Despite then-Atlanta Mayor William Hartsfield moving to integrate the police force for the first time in 1948, Lewis was incredibly distressed by finding this information. Specifically, he found himself angry with relatives whom he didn't feel raised enough hell at the risk of losing their standing among their hierarchy of black folks in Atlanta. No thanks to John Levering Bell Sr., his son's death may still have been useful to campaign for black police officers, he writes in the book's final chapter, with all deliberate speed. It's a fact that Lewis had to begrudgingly accept. You have to keep an objective ambition and a personal one separate, he said. Loss is prevalent throughout Lewis's story. He talked about the last conversation he had with his father, a moment addressed in the stained glass window. Lewis hopes his work as a historian is a legacy that would make mom and dad proud. I hope in a small way that the books I've written are useful, he said. With the stained glass window, Lewis's investigative expedition into his family history and their influence on Atlanta is more than useful, it's necessary. That was a review of the book, The Stained Glass Window, A Family History as the American Story, 1790 to 1958, written by David Levering Lewis. This appeared in the article, Scholar's New Book Excavates His History, written by Gavin Godfrey, which appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 19, 2025. My final reading on today's African American Hour will be a book review from the BlackAgendaReport.com website. This is a review of the book, Black Religion in the Madhouse, Race and Psychiatry in Slavery's Wake, written by Judith Weisenfeld. This interview was conducted by Roberto Servant. In this series, we ask acclaimed authors to answer 5 questions about their book. This week's featured author is Judith Weisenfeld. Weisenfeld is a professor in the Department of Religion at Princeton University. Her book is Black Religion in the Madhouse, Race and Psychiatry in Slavery's Wake. Roberto Servant, how can your book help Black Agenda Report readers understand the current political and social climate? Judith Weisenfeld, Black Religion in the Madhouse traces the emergence in the late 19th century United States of a psychiatric discourse that pathologized black religion, especially Africana religious practices like conjure and ecstatic forms of black Protestant worship, as a precipitating cause of mental illness. It explores how white psychiatrists' racialized theories of black people's purported religious excess, superstition, and susceptibility to charismatic religious leaders contributed to commitment to state hospitals and shaped the practices of care within institutions. In Slavery's Wake, the dominant white psychiatric theory in the United States presented black people as more prone to religious excitement because of what psychiatrists claimed were innate racial characteristics that demonstrated a fundamental unfitness for freedom. Even as psychiatric theory changed over the course of the 20th century, many of these ideas about black religion as a psychologically disabling factor persisted in medical approaches to race and mental health. Current discourse about an expansive mental health crisis is located in a social climate in which mental illness has been criminalized and people with mental illness are often confined in America's jails and prisons. We also know that people with mental illness make up a significant percentage of those shot and killed by police in the United States, and that a disproportionate number of these victims are black. I hope that Black Religion in the Madhouse contributes to more nuanced understanding of the historical background to racialized criminalizing of mental illness and the intersections of anti-blackness, economic precarity, and mental illness. Religion may not be an obvious factor in the contemporary story, but a case like that of Sonia Massey, who was shot and killed in 2024 by a white Springfield, Illinois sheriff's deputy, is striking. The deputy claims that he interpreted her religious exclamation, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus," as a sign of derangement and a prelude to violence, prompting him to shoot in self-defense. The book provides a history of how ideas about race and religion became entangled in framings of black people as mentally unsound and as social dangers. 2. What do you hope activists and community organizers will take away from reading your book? In Black Religion in the Madhouse, I highlight several black community activists in the 1940s and 50s who joined the black clergy and the first substantial cohort of black psychiatrists to shift theory and practice in black mental health care. Black psychiatrists at the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital refuted theories about innate race traits, including supposed religious dispositions, and turned attention to how social environment, and particularly racism, could foster the development of mental illness. Activists like Rosa Cottrell mobilized her connections to churches and religious organizations to advocate for community-based mental hygiene clinics to address the lack of access to psychotherapy in black communities and intervene to avoid institutionalization. Activists and community organizers have long addressed health disparities that stem from anti-black racism, unequal access to treatments, and disparate care and have pioneered ways to address these at the macro and micro levels. I hope that learning about Cottrell and others might help activists and organizers locate their work in a longer history of community-based responses to criminalization and institutionalization. The book also shows that, even in a context in which the value of religious freedom is enshrined in the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, racialized conceptions of religion, and in this case, racialized through medical pathologizing, shape understandings of what constitutes religion itself and what kinds of religious beliefs and practices merit protection. The norming of certain kinds of religion in American politics and public life has been enabled by marginalizing others. Such religious othering is obvious in the most overt forms, but medical pathologizing has been less well understood. I hope activists and community organizers might become even better attuned to the more subtle ways racialized and medical discourses can function to constrain the free exercise of religion. 3. We know readers will learn a lot from your book, but what do you hope readers will unlearn? In other words, is there a particular ideology you're hoping to dismantle? It is common to imagine that the consolidation of scientific and medical authority displaced religious understandings of health and disease in the 19th and 20th century United States, and that, for psychiatrists and other physicians, science and religion stood in opposition to one another. In working to learn more about the white Southern physicians who developed theories about black religion as both a symptom and a sign of disordered minds, I found that not only did many have personal or family experiences as enslavers of black people, but most were also active and engaged in mainstream Protestant churches. Late 19th and early 20th century white psychiatric theorists of black religions and mental normalcy brought religious commitments as Baptists, Methodists, and Episcopalians, for example, to their treatment of patients. Their personal religious sensibilities about what constitutes true, orderly, and socially beneficial religion grounded their assessments of their black patients' religious beliefs, expressions, and institutions as superstitious or overly emotional. I came to see this story not as a contest between the authority of science and medicine on the one hand and the religious worlds of formerly enslaved African Americans and their descendants on the other, but of two religiously informed approaches to health and society engaging one another on a field of unequal power. Remaining alert to how religious understandings persisted through the changing course of race sciences in the late 19th and early 20th centuries gave me a new perspective on the relationship of religion, race, and science that I hope readers will find useful. 4. Which intellectuals or intellectual movements most inspire your work? My work in this book has benefited enormously from scholars focused on race and medicine, especially Rana Hogarth, Deidre Cooper Owens, Dorothy Roberts, Keith Wailoo, and Harriet Washington, to name a few, and from the recent literature on African Americans in psychiatry by scholars like Jonathan Metzi, Mobb Sechrist, and Martin Summers. In the area of race and religion, Sylvester Johnson, Catherine Lum, and Terence Keel have had a profound influence on my work, and a host of pioneering black studies scholars, including Sadia Hartman, Christina Sharp, and Rinaldo Walcott, have inspired me. 5. Which two books published in the last 5 years would you recommend to Black Agenda Report readers? How do you envision engaging these titles in your future work? Recovering the stories of black patients in Black Religion in the Madhouse was an especially challenging part of the research process because the archival record privileges the voices of white doctors and hospital officials, police, judges, employers, etc., and the frameworks of medical racism are so prominent and powerful in the written record. The texture of patients' lives, family and community connections, and spiritual aspirations are fleeting in the textual materials I examine, and in many cases, records were discarded or obscured by health privacy regulations. As I have navigated these challenges, I have been drawn to work that uses personal and family history to tell larger stories about Black life in the United States. Crystal Wilkinson's culinary memoir, Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghost, Stories and Recipes from Five Generations of Black Country Cooks, is a beautiful book, both in word and image, that foregrounds the histories of Black Appalachians and of Wilkinson's own family going back generations. The kitchen is a site of spiritual power for Wilkinson, and the recipes she shares evoke connections with her ancestors and highlight the importance of mobilizing a range of sources, such as food and foodways, in addition to textual ones. Tia Miles, All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, A Black Family Keepsake, also demonstrates the world of stories contained within material culture. I was profoundly moved when I saw the sack, passed down through generations, on display in the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. Embroidery on the fabric preserves the story of 9-year-old Ashley, separated forever from her mother Rose, and left with a sack containing a dress, some pecans, a braid of Rose's hair, and filled with my love always. Miles's book fleshes out Rose and Ashley's story and the story of the sack in a memorable way. With the current presidential administration's efforts to erase public representation of Black life and history, I'm drawn to the need for us to reclaim and tell seemingly small stories in the face of mounting opposition to Black presence. That was the book review of Black Religion in the Madhouse, Race and Psychiatry in Slavery's Wake, written by Judith Weisenfeld. It was published April 2, 2025, at the BlackAgendaReport.com website, and the interview was conducted by Roberto Servant. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.